Thanks very much, John, for this catch. I thought we could just look at the, because you've done a lot of artistic work in your life. Do you have a count of how many plays, many movies?
No.
You don't keep a count?
No. I'm sometimes surprised when someone said, I Googled, I hear you did a movie. Yes. In 1982, I said, what was it? No, I don't. My life is about now, the things that I want to do, the things that challenge me, the things that I feel are important to that we bring them to the table of discussion, or the idea I have of how would I use my art as a writer, as an actor, as a director, and unashamedly so as a cultural activist. So those are the things then for. So each project is followed by the next project and the next project and the next project. And for me, the most important one is the one I'm involved with now. And then later I look back and I says, wow, I've done more than 50 plays, 100, I don't know how many they are. I've done more than 20 to 30 movies. You know, I've done more television work abroad and in this country. So when I only look back, but I don't have a count that would quickly come in my mind.
Yes.
All I know that I've got more than 25 Lifetime Achievement Awards. I should be dead by now. Lifetime Achievement Award.
I wanted to ask you, let's end right at the beginning. You are in New Brighton.
New Brighton.
How do you end up in the theater and then you end up in Joburg and all over the world practically? How did you get into the theater? What attracted you to the theater? Were you always wanting to be an actor or an entertainer?
You know, Mike, you grew up in the township, born in 1943 on the 30th of August. So as you go to the 45 and the 46 and if you go to school, you know, early 51, 52, and all your parents are trying is to get you a standard 6 certificate so that at least you can get a job that not as an as a laborer, so that of course you could also with the standard 6 certificate go into the bar and buy a bottle, because black people are not allowed to buy liquor in public for outlets. You have to use we call them mules those days. You'd use a colored guy to go in and buy my father's bottle of eau de mieste. Yeah, so, but basically, you as soon as you got that standard 6, you could find a job. And then you go into what we call then the secondary education, and slowly the dreams begin to formulate, what do I want to be? When I was doing matric, I just wanted to be a lawyer. I had this incredible thing about the human rights lawyer. And every time I mentioned this to my father, he stopped me on the tracks. Lama Buna is going to kill you. Don't talk about human rights here. We want to be, why don't you be a lawyer defending criminals? You'll make a lot of money.
Safer there.
Safer there, you know. And I had that idea, you know. But you grow up then in New Brighton, which was at that time the hot seat of the campaigning. Of mobilizing the youth to be able to be moved out of the country to go and to do military training. That's what occupied us most as young people in the early 50s and the early 60s. It's like we wanted to be underground operatives. We didn't even know how to spell the bloody thing. We didn't know how do we become that. We went to school. There were two schools. You went to the 8-2, which is the normal Bantu education school. And in the afternoon, we went to the CADA classes near Pioneer Brighton, as an NS Kosana. There was a classroom there. Kupaya Ukomisa Usispriti. Usispriti gave us the life of the struggle and how it began right from 1652. She went even beyond 1652 when there were other issues that we were challenged with. So then that would bring us up. But we had to be ready, because as soon as we hear Usoteu, there was this 1320, the blue van of the police that was driving around looking at any groupings of people. So as soon as we say 13320, we jump and we run. And Sispitri, who was a big mama, you know, those 56 double D cup, she jumped over the fence much faster than all of us. And that then mixed my life with wanting to be educated, wanting an education, also wanting to be part of the movement that was happening within New Brighton, within the Eastern Cape. So then you pass your matric and you think, right, now I'm ready. I register at 40 and I get accepted. I'm going to do a law degree. Mm-hmm. And I had an uncle who was like our eldest brother, Uheri Khan, Ustel. He was, my father was the only person who paid for education, because those days, the education of a black child was not compulsory, and it was not free. So you paid from grade nothing. So the parents struggled to keep the kids at school. I still remember going to Cowan Secondary School, Emma Dalla Street. The school fees was 1 rand issue me a year. And people could not afford issue me, which is the equivalent of about 10 rand now, a year, and people could not afford. So it was really like the few of families that were working. My mother was a maid working in the kitchen. My father worked at the administration office, you know. And one day he sent me to go and fetch something from his room, and I pulled the drawer and I saw my father's pay slip, 58 rand a month. I stood very quietly. That was in 1961. And I made the decision. I owe this old man. I owe this mama. And I have to do something. I owe them. It was some debt. That was an incredible investment that I was conscious of. Of course, then I passed my matric at Newell High School. Now, the bug of acting, it started just a pre there. There was a teacher there, John S. Mdela. He was our history teacher at Newell High School. He used to take some of the prescribed literature, textbook. And before me, when I was still doing Form 4, those days, the Form 4 is now grade 11. Yeah. They did a production of T.S. Eliot, Murder in the Cathedral. And I went to see this. Wow, just these people on stage sort of pretending to be white people somewhere and speaking good English. And his next project was, 1962, was Buzani Gubao by W.K. Tamsak, which is The Old Order Changeth. And Winston John, I met him at Newell High School.
Oh, you met him at school?
I went to school. We were doing matric together. Now, Winston was an avid sports person. Winston was victory ludorum in every discipline, cricket, rugby, tennis. He was like absolutely the sort of, even the Spring Rose Football Club of New Brighton kept an eye on that boy, kept an eye. And he would put me in, because there's a friend, and I played eighth man, and for the first team. For me, I did it for the girls, because to wear that first team jersey, you know, you ran across like this. I was only a member of the debating society. Who was so verbose in his speech. He said, the former speaker is suffering from the verbosity of his diarrhea. Jesus, it was to just excite. So I walked in this rehearsal that Winston was in it. I was not in it. Buzani Kubawen was playing Guguletu, a really beautiful story, play. And there was a young man there who played Uzwilakhe, the father. And he came home so drunk that he could hardly stop and fall. And I made my mouth, because the teacher allowed me to stand at the back waiting for Winston.
Okay.
So as soon as the rehearsals are over, we walk together home. New Brighton. Right. So when I said, come on, nobody's drunk like that. And the teacher said, excuse me? I said, nobody gets drunk like that. That's too much. How the hell is he going to make it home? And then he said, well, show me how. I said, I'll tell you something. When my father is very drunk and he's coming home, he tries 150% to show my mother he's sober. So you go against it. So my father would walk like this, and he's only trying to get to the door handle, and he looks at the distance between the door and the bedroom, and he counts how many steps to the bed, and he suddenly falls on the bed. Mm. But my mom knew that he was completely drunk. Mm-hmm. The young person was given another role. I played Winston's father, 1962, and thus began my bug for this acting, for this storytelling format, for this drama, for this communicating and telling a story to an audience and feeling the audience receiving. Mm-hmm. And we had an incredible time. That's when I met Winston. Mm. 1965, I hear from Fats Boholane that there's a group called the Serpent Players. Mm-hmm. These guys are rehearsing at the old campus in Bird Street. Port Elizabeth, there was a Rose outside, there was a Rose University campus there, a small one. So I went to check them out. So Fred said, come man, let's see what's happening, you know, because we need some young people, we're doing a play. But I've already heard that they are the strange group, because they don't do musicals. They all do English things. Go Mr. M, excuse me. Go Bonomen Chinga. Go Welcome Duhu, go Maligan Bikwana, go Mabel Magada. Those are the creme de la creme of the socialized man. These are the Aussies what is respect, man. And I arrived into this group where they were rehearsing. They're doing a play called Antigone by Sophocles. And I walked in. First, as I walked past the door to this dilapidated, to be demolished building, Kempston Road. Yeah, just opposite the police station. So I walked past, there was a poor-looking white man smoking a pipe with a brown jersey with the elbows showing. I didn't even say hi to him. I walked past and I got in. And when I was inside, and Fred said to the others, "Oh, put Maligan, oh, put Mondo, oh, put George, oh, put Shakum Gukula, Zitishara is, oh, Banina, oh, Nantishupinyaneng." So I said, hi, Fett said to me, "Hey, this young man has been in plays, so at least he's got an idea. So maybe we can use him as well." And then that white man comes in. And Fett says, "Hey, Athol." That was Athol Fugard. "Hey, Athol, this is John. John, this is Athol. This is now 1965. It's the first time in my life I'm introduced to a white person on a first name basis." It was not John, this is Mr. Fugard. Mr. Fugard, this is John. Arthur, he just said, my Fred said, "Hey, John, this is Athol. Athol, this is John." And Athol said, "Hi, John." Said, "Hi, Athol." I thought, okay, I'm not going to be arrested for disrespecting a white person. So we sat down and they were talking about this play, Antigone. The king. There was a war, and the two brothers were on opposite sides. The one brother was attacking the state and regarded as rising against the authority of state, so could be a terrorist. The other brother was defending the state, could be the supporter of the establishment. They both die in the battle. Now the king decides that the brother that died defending the state is going to have a state funeral. But the brother that was came like a terrorist to attack the state is going to be left on the open field to rot there. Now the sister, Antigone, is confronted with a very difficult decision. Do I obey the law of the state and not bury my brother? Or do I challenge the law of the state and take the law of humanity, take the law of God and bury my brother and take the consequences? For some strange reason, it resonated with me with the struggle. And we had the apartheid sort of creature as a government, the white nationalist minority government as the state. And therefore, these guys are talking about you can defy the state. You can defy the law if the law is unjust. I could easily say the rest is history. So that was it. That's the bark. It came from... of course, the fact that also my grandfather, who died at 101, my grandmother, who died at 106, and my grandfather had three wives and could not spell polygamy. He didn't know what polygamy meant. He just said another wife. Hey, what's your problem?
He just saw his life.
He saw his life.
Know, working. You know?
Now, and my grandfather did not like religion because it put some Jewish family, that's how he put it, above him and his ancestors. Didn't mean that he has nothing with it. When I talk about, but Joseph, no, Abraham, what, gumnilo. Gumnu Abraham. Then I said, I don't know, is it Jewish? So why are you telling me this Jewish story? Two, my father, grandfather did not want school education because he took the kids away from their chores of looking after the goats and the cattle and their sheep, because he was there, sort of at a farm. And my grandfather did also felt that when they come back from school, they don't stop talking. So he wanted us to work in the fields and he wanted us to look after the cattle. But it was grandma number two who said, no, the children will go to school and the children will go to the church. Grandma number three was a beautician. My grandfather was in his 80s when he married her. So it was like, she once asked me, she was the person who saw the beauty of human nature, the beauty of the surrounding, the care about when you go to look for wood to cook. Don't take the branch from the standing tree. Pick up the ones on the floor. But one day she said to me, do you know that little girl? I said, yeah, Tembisa. Yeah, well, Nosipo. Yeah, Nosipo, yeah. Do you know? I said, yeah. When you look at her, what do you see? I said, ah, Makulma. No sip. I said, no, I'm asking seriously. When you look at the what do you see? I said, no sip. I know her. Where's like, he said, you see me. You look at that girl, you see me. Whatever you're going to say to that girl must be something you could also say to me. Whatever you do to that girl must be something you know I'll be proud of you. That was my first lesson in gender respect, to respect for women. That is, I've kept those three grand ladies. So they're storytellers, because grandmother number one was a storyteller. She's the one who told me that I am a descendant of the Batembu clan, Amantlochan, Omjaja, blah, 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 would go on. And she would tell me that my great-great-grandfather was the prince who was ready to be inaugurated at the death of his father as to be the Xhosa chief. But he went out hunting. And by the time he was out there, the old man died, old king died. And then the kingdom was given to the descendants of Kamatanzim. And he said, Singondobe, that I will one day return the kingdom to you. That's my count bong. Meaning I am waiting for the Matanzima and all those chiefs there to tend the kingdom to me. I didn't understand then, but I really, and now I understood that she was preparing me for the onslaught of this dehumanizing apartheid system that would define me not just as a non-human, but as a thing. And if I believe truly that I am of great nobility and great line of kings, I would be above the onslaught of the dehumanizing apartheid. And that's in my art, in my work, in my life. I always say apartheid never, never affected me. It was something that I was determined to fight and destroy. So me and apartheid had an ongoing war all the time. Even when you called me a boy, I would respond, I'm not a boy, simply because we're at war. And I know at war you despise your family, the enemy. You denigrate the family. You take away the culture of the family. You take away the belief in humanity of the family. While you, because that then makes your soldiers easy to kill, because they're not killing a human being. Right.
You've performed in many different places around the world. You know, what are some of the highlights of that? Did you have like memories? You know, that you feel were
We're doing Sizwe Banzi Is Dead around Joburg. We are at D.H. Williams. We are at Uncle Tom Hall. We are at DOCC. We go to the Tembisa. We go to Mamelodi. We're performing in school classrooms, you know. And we got Sizwe Banzi Is Dead. We don't even aware how powerful this thing is. Because the only thing that indicated, why are the police so interested in this? You know, we opened at the Space Theater in Cape Town and the cops came and wanted to close the performance. And then we said, well, we're going to continue. Because we had people who told us, you know. For instance, Francis Lovett, who was a lecturer at UCT at that time, said, they can't arrest you at the first warning. You see, and also, there must be someone who complains about the political content of the work as dangerous. Then the police could come and stop it. But we were attracting the converted white liberal. They were the people coming to see the play. And our people as well. And when we put our plays at the Sizwe Banzi at St. Stephen's Hall, which is my Broadway, because that church hall had a curtain. Other church hall didn't have a curtain.
So and this was where?
This is St. Stephen's in New Brighton.
New Brighton. Okay.
It's, that was, you perform at St. Stephen's, you've arrived, Boot, because it has a curtain. Because others, in Wellesley Hall, in Holwin, it's just the hall. But that one had the lifted stage and the curtain. So, wow, we got there. Black people were afraid to come and see Sizwe Banzi Is Dead because we could all be arrested. When I got my father to see the play, and he and my mother were wanting to walk out because they said it's a political meeting. This is Sizwe Banzi Is Dead. There are 200 seats and there are 700 people in the hall. So we had to perform in a corner. And suddenly, a young director from London, the Royal Court Theatre, English stage company, sneaked in and saw the play when we were doing it in Cape Town. He had come to see a mother who's aging mother in Cape Town, went back to England and said to the English stage company, I've seen something. I've never seen theatre that way ever in my life. So we get the invitation immediately to go to England.
And it's you and Winston Jordan.
Yes, and of course, Athol, the director. While we are waiting, because Athol at that stage was banned, so now we have to apply for a passport. But he then applies. Winston applies, I apply. Right. Athol in 3 weeks gets the passport. Winston in about 9 or 10 weeks gets the passport. I don't. Well, of course my involvement. Of course my brother, my uncle is on Robben Island doing 5 years, Ustela. Of course, me, I've been detained, I've been chased. Of course, my younger brother, Ukolile, who was shot by the police in 1985, has been part of that. So I knew it would be impossible. So what we then do is to inform the English stage company that we are unable to come because John can't get a passport to come. And the English stage company got to talk to the High Commissioner. I still remember, as I said to Mr. van der Walt, of, what do you mean you can't give an actor a passport to come and do a play in England? Do you know how much money we've already invested in promoting and marketing? And then I get the call that I should come to Pretoria to come, live in New Brighton. And I had knew a friend of mine, Janet Sussman, who is the niece of Helen Sussman. So I said, can your aunt help? He said, okay, I'll talk to my aunt. So I get then the call from the aunt here, Helen Sussman. John, you can go to the Civitas building. It's on a phone. I mean, Civitas building on a phone and go there and get a passport. Because this is about late much. So I get in the train. I get here. Namath. I get here.
All the way to Joburg.
Kaloku, they think that a passport there to a New Bride. A passport is a Pretoria. So I arrive here, this is now 1973. Yes, 73. A friend of mine who lives in Joburg, Manny Menem, who later founded the Market Theater, he drives me in a kumbi to Pretoria. So he stops. And it's the first time in Pretoria, and it's lunchtime, because my appointment is 2:30. I've never seen so many people in uniform. I come from a small town, Port Elizabeth, man, in a main street car. I've never been on a city. Everybody in Pretoria was in uniform. I thought there was a riot or there was some rising. Are they expecting some big march? I thought, my God. So I go in. Many waits outside. I get shouted here. Who the hell do I think I am? That they should receive instructions from the leader of the opposition, that they should give me a travel document. Who the hell do I think I am? I'm standing there thinking, do I get Hardehat and say, to hell with you, and don't get the passport? Because I want to go overseas. You see, that's the thing. Yeah. I also want to go overseas.
You have to go and perform.
So I keep quiet. And this, how do you know Helen Suzman? I said, no, I have a friend of mine who is in England now. She's an actress. Janet Suzman. It's her aunt. So when I said to them, I'm still having a problem, they say maybe the aunt could help. So finally, he pulls a drawer and he gives me, here, go. It's brown. I know the South African passport is green. You know, with that logo of the Springboks like this. This is brown. And this thing is written, document for travel purposes. I still have it. Open the page, nationality unbepaled, stroke undetermined. Nationality undetermined. Next line, the South African government bears no responsibility whatsoever of the bearer of this document. Meaning if I were to be arrested in England or deported, the South African wouldn't pay the fees. I'm standing there, I'm so many. He said, well, the only thing we can do, we can try and see what happens. So the day to leave for England, we arrive, I get to Port Elizabeth, we go at the then Jan Smuts, I hand it over. The guy looks at me, next I go. I arrive in London at Heathrow, now I'm trying to find a nice looking face so that I could explain what is this document. So I go there and this white woman says, what is this? I said, I couldn't call it passport. It's my travel document. What do you mean undetermined? What is your nationality? I said, I'm an African. I'm South African. He said, what's written here? Jesus, the bloody government. In anger of what the South African government is doing to me, the customs and immigration gave me an entry to England. I used that entry when I went to America, Australia, New Zealand, Paris, because if the British immigration had accepted that as a proper legal document, they too would.
Oh, so it's a precedent.
Right. So we then open the Royal Court Theatre. I hear there's a bit of a rumble outside, packed. We're going to do Sizwe Banzi is dead. And there's also, people are talking about, there are some people here who, I don't know whether you know them, they belong some of these exiled groups. Oh, you're okay with that? I'm fine. I don't know who's outside. So we open the play. Wow. Every time we sing a song, the people, every time we make a comment, there's people in the audience saying, yeah. So in the end, you go to this press conference, and then we are taken quickly to another room and to meet. There were about four people, but in front was O.R. Tambo, Adelaide, Trevor Huddleston, and Robert Gesha. It made that night like a Royal Command performance. The English went wild. 5-star reviews every day. They have never seen a play structure and performance and content done in the manner we did Sizwe Banzi's Dead. We became stars the following day. We arrived from New Brighton and landed in a room, rehearsed, and the following day, everywhere. There was a line in front of the theater as we left to go for the next performance. Autograph seekers. And I thought, Winston, we could like this.
This is the life.
This is the life. So that was the first experience. I will never forget the opening of Sizwe Banzi's Dead in London, where O.R. Tambo said to both Winston and I, what you did tonight in an hour and a half is what we've been trying to convince the British politicians and decision makers about the inhumanity of the apartheid system. Mm. You did it in 90 minutes. Mm. We will remember that. Mm. So we used to boast, no, Winston. I'm a coming to say Jerusalem with you. I'm a coming to fuck with blood rich there, I say Jerusalem. Yeah, we used to boast about that. Mm. So if some of the highlights would be that. And of course, going to New York, open on Broadway. Now, people don't understand, there's on Broadway, then there's off Broadway, and then there's off Broadway. You don't come from nowhere without starting from off and move to off Broadway and then move to on Broadway. So we went straight to on Broadway. Wow. And there's two of us. And the theater sits 1,400. The Edison Theater. Right neck of, right around the Times Square. On Sosmas Mukhufan P.E. Siyambe Times Square, Siyambe Ranj. Uzaku, I'm going to be building Zenza Ranj. Hey, man. On Sosmukhufan P.E. Usenza, Siyazin Doni Getu. We opened the play, and then it's like sold out. Interviews, television, every day. No one is asking of us about the play. Every interview wants to know about Sharpeville, about 76, the murder of the children, about apartheid, about Robben Island, about the struggle of the ANC, about Nelson Mandela. I still remember The Guardian, Michael Billinting says, John Carney and Winston are the only actors that are not asked the question, how did you make up this role? They're asked, when are you overthrowing the South African government? So, man, it was unbelievable. Then, but when we opened on Broadway, then suddenly we heard that we were nominated for the Tony Award. So we had to find out what's the Tony Award. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it's the highest accolade ever in the theater. It's an equivalent to the Oscar. So, okay, this time we added in the repertoire The Island, right? So Winston is nominated, I'm nominated, and then Arthur is nominated for Best Director. Then Winston and I again nominated for Best Writer.
For in relation to which one?
Both of them. So we are what we don't know yet, whether was I nominated for Caesar and Winston was nominated for The Island. I'm not, they didn't make it clear, right? So the booking suddenly shoots up another 110% once you are nominated. So we then on a Sunday, we go to the Tony Award event. And we get a bit of a brown suit and a black suit. We arrive, because remember when you do The Island, our heads are shaved clean. We arrive at the same time with the mayor of New York, but we're just walking behind. So we were seen as the bodyguards. Me and Winston were seen. They could perhaps be the bodyguards of the mayor. We sit down. You know the bookie thing that Peter Firth is like 14 to 10 to win the best actor.
Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins, you know, so-and-so, Ben Gazzara, Jane McCallum. These are big actors. There was even Medici wrote, Angela Lansbury. There was also what you call Ellen Bernstein for best actress and all, and Judge Gordon. Really, Winston and I just do a job. And as soon as we finish, we want to go home. So we're sitting down there, and it is Walter Matthau with, I just forgotten the other girl now, who went to read the winner. You know, the nominees for Best Actor are, first, John Kenai, Anthony Hopkins, so on, Rex Harrison, Winston Chonai. So we're laughing, sitting there, packed. And then Walter Matthau says, oh no, the winners are, for the first time, the Tony was given to two actors, not sharing it. One got a Tony because they couldn't separate the performances. So they decided to honor both actors with the Best Actor Tony Award. the celebrations in New York from Zex Mukai, from Okoya, from Tamim Mhlambiso, from Prof. Hositsile or Sambete, the whole entourage. I mean, it was like the biggest thing. The biggest thing that has happened. And it was first time ever that an actor outside the US, French, English, or what, don't even mention Africa, that they win the best actor. Mm. That's strictly preserved for America. Of course, that is a memorable moment. Beyond that, we found out quite later what a Tony Award is. It immediately removes me trying to get permit and visas to work anywhere. Mm. I just say, he's a Tony Award winner. I get a work permit. I get a visa. It lifts you from the level of earning. Mm. It lifts you to a particular a number of zeros. So we won the Tony on a Sunday, on a Tuesday, because Monday is off. And then we looked at the salary Friday. There were two zeros to what we were offered before. Mm. There were two zeros. If you can remember, going to the bank, it was the Manhattan Bank, we had to open an account. I can't keep this money in the bedroom now. And we have like a 9 months ahead of bookings. Mm-hmm. So go then open an account because I could bank this money. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to know, what do I do? I mean, how do I come in with nearly $15,000 like this? Mm. Plus, like a year before, can be money and the bank.
Okay.
Yeah. Money can be a pine note and a bank transfer draft for Inkoska Zekai. And now they were really shocked. So those are the two moments for me, is that New Brighton performance, is that opening in London and meeting Oor Tambo. It's winning the Tony Award for Best Actor on Broadway with Winston John.
And your life has been, in a sense, your professional life has been intertwined with the politics of the country.
There's one thing.
Your family, seems to have been impacted directly, So you're not like telling a story or a hearsay.
No, not at all. Not at all. The point is, I normally say, when apartheid discriminates, it did not discriminate on who you are. Mm. You could have been a teacher or a doctor. You still have to carry a passport, and you can't go to a restaurant. You can't do this. You have to live in the community, in the townships, on rural areas. And in the Wage Act bill, you cannot be paid equal to a white person. And which became, when I started my theater career, like in the early 80s here, there was something that was called the management secret. Mm-hmm. Having won a Tony Award, doing plays in South Africa, it's like, how much is John paid in comparison what other actors, white actors, are paid? So management could not divulge that because it might cause an unhappiness. Mm-hmm. When you look at the difference between the salaries. And the management treated me as an international successful star, but the actors around here felt like they were kind of curious, about why am I treated like this. In 1987, Janet Sussman wants to direct Othello. Now, Othello, we know all about, is about this black man who wants to marry the white daughter of the Duke, and suddenly racism explodes. And yet this is the man who just saved the entire Venetian state against the attack of the Ottomans. So it's okay to entertain you, but to say that we are non-racial. It's okay to say we don't see race, but we forgot to tell our daughters not to fall in love with you, because Sidney Poitier's Guest Who's Coming to Dinner is based on that play, Othello. Right.
You mentioned your uncle on Robben Island.
Yes. Mm. O. Harry would write letters with, he graduated at BSc at Wits, and he was doing a master's at Rhodes University on chemical, biological, I don't know. Me and my father didn't know what the hell. Kodinga ngati kunobungozi biochemical doing. So then my uncle, do you know actually when my he was member of the underground nabo Leslie Mqinwa from East London, yonke la genge youth movement within the schools. They were the opposition to NUSAS before SASCO, the South African student before. And then we would send us letters, right? We called them with windows because the Boers would cut out all the terms they don't understand. So you would read a letter. So I had to make it up for my parents that he says he's fine. He says he's okay, right? And he was the one actually who introduced me to jazz. While before he was arrested, you know, he would come to my mother's place and then, hey, do you know Ornette Coleman? I said, who's that? Then does do the puka nam nam. Does unik moya come? Does umake diversity? Listen to this. My God, listen to this. My God. And that's my love. And even in politics, he was careful as how much he parts over to you. He was very, very careful. So he spent six years on Robben Island and he came back. In 1973, when we created the island, the play called The Island, some of the information I got from those letters he used to send me about you. I said, Lama Bulog Kaulimbo Ondogwiti. Be careful what you say. Don't talk too much. Right. And then when I was rehearsing Antigone in 1965, the actor playing the second lead, Ubutshak Gugula, was arrested, sent to Robben Island for 7 years, PAC. He never performed the play. He rehearsed. I took over from him. My first speaking major role in Antigone. Then we got this information from my brother, from my uncle, Ustelo, that, hey, Ushak is doing a one-man performance of Antigone during lunch on the island when we work at the quarry. So we all laughed because he never knew the words. He never knew the words. So the island, we brought in that element of these two prisoners going to take part on a prison concert, but they're doing an extract from Antigone. And it must be so inaccurate because it's from Shark's memory when he didn't know the lines. And that play has won more awards than any other play around the world. It's been done even in Palestine.
Done on Antigone.
The island. It's based on Antigone. The one we created with Arthur and Winston and with Winston. So my uncle, when he came back, he wasn't muted. He was very quiet. Very cautious. And he would talk to me very gently. And I'd like to find out how was life on Robben Island. That's fine. There were days things were very tough. Some days were fine. It's fine. And I wanted to know, because as a writer, I'm trying to make notes. And I realized the people who went through that kind of suffering did not want to burden their children or relatives with the horror of that past. And I found that while I was working in America, it's the same thing from the enslaved people who grew up during those days, is that they all talked about it was difficult for their grandfathers or great-grandfathers to hand over that horror of being a slave or an enslaved person. So there was that not handing over than to say, but all he said that there were days that death was the option. But then you would ask yourself, why am I here for? And you'd remind yourself, for a better South Africa. For a better free South Africa. And those are the little vignettes I got from him.
And you yourself were arrested at some point?
Oh, yes, because we were doing a Greek play, was in 19, whatever, called the Baka. I don't, we just wanted to wear gowns and arms. Because I was directing. And then you get detained, and then you get asked about it. We performed in Durban, where I met Seth Scooper.
Oh, yeah.
And Strini Moodley, right? And they were doing something called, Antigone Tech, an adaptation of that. And that's when we even formed the South African Black Theatre Union, which was banned immediately with Abo Nangwenkulu.
Oh, Harry.
Yes. And Strinley, Sam, and Helen, and Alan Joseph, and Benji Francis. We were in Durban, and that is it. So when you come back, you get detained. But it was only when I had won the Tony Award in 1975. We went to Australia, and then in 1976, we were performing in the Transkei. And then we performed in this hall in the, doing the Sizwebanz is Dead in Tata. Mm-hmm. And when we walked out, we heard, hey, we're not, Special Brands looking for you, you too. And we said, oh, we were looking for them too. Amen. We were stars, Mike. You can't arrest us. We got Tony Award. We were winners. We're internationals. How can you arrest us for a play? So we took it very light.
Yeah.
So we're now performing a Butterworth Egu in the town hall. It's about 500 people, and 120 or something are white. It's jam packed. And during the play, I noticed that there are people in uniform and not in uniform blocking the exit doors. And I knew, oh my God. And something I always hated is to be detained, not in Port Elizabeth or in a place where Kutedwa, a language I can't speak. I realized there's that there are lines in the play that there's Bantus to Transkei in San Francisco independence is shit. And I said by Winston, there's nothing like that independence die there. It's just like sitting with your little pond dock and the wind blows the dust and you cough your lungs out. And South Africa, I'm going to say it about whether you're ready or not. La independence, So, see, I pull me the arrested. In Butterworth, Winston gets into another car. I get into another car. I'm sitting here. There's this, the two white guys at the back. The black guy's driving another white guy. And this guy's got the gun here. And I'm thinking, man, this thing is hurting. I'm in costume when I was arrested.
Oh, you haven't even changed.
No, we're taken from the stage. And the guns were like this. And the kids were trying to grab us away from them. We arrived in Tata. We're sitting down there, and everybody says, come on, listen. So now we sit there, and this Lieutenant Foray says your name and says, it tells us you are being charged under the section R400 for furthering the aims of banned organization, for spreading communism, disrespect to the state, and to this to the ANC, and this to this, and there's charges there. That could send me away. A terrorism act and all that. Winston is sitting now. Winston is anti-uniform. He starts sweating. I have to explain, it's a postman. It's not a policeman. He starts sweating. He starts sweating. So we get into different cars. I'm taken to Ngqeleni outside Port St. John's. He's taken to Elliotdale, so I don't see each other. For 23 days in solitary confinement.
This is in the Transkei.
In the Transkei. No, it was not Transkei then. It's Transkei, part of South Africa. Because it was before the actual independence.
So you were talking about it. Yes. But it had not yet happened.
It had not yet become an independent state. 15 days, I'm sitting in the cell. All I'm thinking about is Winston, because I know he's claustrophobic and extremely claustrophobic. Winston, not liking small spaces, had a better benefit for me because they had to book a suite for us.
Oh.
Because he didn't like. So it went before by the agent that one of our actors is extremely claustrophobic. Peace. He's going to only make it on a suite. So I said, you don't lose that disease well. Otherwise, we're going to go to single rooms. So we then went to, one day I was taken to Mtata from Ngqeleni. It's about 2-hour drive to be interrogated and to be told that what's my relationship with the Communist Party, with the ANC, with the PAC, what is my relationship with. They knew everybody we had met in America and England. Or part of the people in exile. How do you know these people? What do they say to you? What are these? What are the? I'm thinking, I did a play you didn't like. Then I said, I want to talk to my lawyer. I don't have one at all. Say, who's your lawyer? I remembered Black Sash, Port Elizabeth. Those women, I knew Barbara Ubabi. Her husband was Neil Melansky, Juicy. I said, Neil Melansky, Juicy. And the guy walked out. They went to talk outside because Neil Melansky apparently had advised the constitution of the Transkei that will be adopted after its independence. So they knew who Neil Melansky was. So he comes back and he gives me a paper, thick, like I must sign at the bottom. It's a confession of that I'm not an actor, I am an activist that is used by the ANC and the Communist Party to do this, to create hatred among races, to promote a revolution where whites will be, there'll be a bloody revolution. Now, there are two black guys standing behind Lieutenant Foray, young guys. So I'm looking at this, and the guy on the left does this. Danga Mike, it was not even a hundredth of a degree. Sign, and that guy looked at me and said, I read in his eyes, he says, don't. I thought I would be forced by law, and then I would defend myself later, that I did not know what I signed or I was forced to sign. But that guy is one of the security, young boy, standing behind Lieutenant Foray. He looked at me and he said, that's all. I said, no, I can't sign until my lawyer sees this document. He said, take him away. In the car, back to Mailin. But on my way out, Winston was about 260 pounds the last time I was arrested. After 15 days, Winston was inside his clothes. He'd lost so much weight. And he looked at me, all right, Ikan, didn't you have a under? It's okay. Never saw Winston. I saw Winston after the 23rd day when we were released. And then we were only released, of course, because of massive demonstrations abroad, all over. They wanted to close down Broadway. They were planning a march to the United Nations to demand our release. Peter Brook, Dr. Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young, every activist around the world demanded our immediate release. So when we were released and got back here, that day provided some form of immunity. Because in 1987, I'd done Othello. And in Othello, I kissed the white Desdemona on stage. That was an offense. So when I was detained, I was released the same day, but after a lot of questions, right? Now, Helen Suzman raises the question in Parliament. Why was John Carney detained? And it's Adrian Flock. He says, no, he was not detained. He was held over for questioning. Why was John Carney kept in solitary confinement? And Adrian Flock replies, no, he was not in solitary confinement. He had a cell to himself.
Oh, okay. Luxury.
It doesn't matter what the size of the cell is, but he had a cell to himself. The last time I was detained was in 19, just before Mandela was released. Just before Mandela was released, I'd come back from a movie I'd done. It's called The Grass is Singing by Doris Lessing. We shot the movie in Zambia and in Stockholm for the studio work. We were shooting in Zambia, in Lusaka. And then I heard that there are people who want to see me. And everybody was kind of, you know, the movie people then. So they look after us. So they wanted to know who are these people and the local people, whites and all that. They didn't. Someone said, they are the underground people from the ANC. So they said, if you don't want to see them, we can tell them to go. I said, that's a death sentence. The ANC wants to see me, and I said, I don't want to see them. Where am I going back to? South Africa. I said, no, no problem. No, no. Anyway, it's lunch. So let's just call them where we are sitting. Thabo Mbeki, Thozamile Botha, Alfred Nzo, Nomlonyi, head of the Radio Africa. Things go better with ANC when the radio starts. Radio Mm. Remember Radio Freedom? Mm. They took things go better with Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Things go better with the ANC. Mm. And I'm sitting with these guys there. My God, I knew I'm in trouble when I get home. We talk, and I talk about this business, about getting home. I said, no, I know they're going to arrest you when you come home. Thabo Mbeki says to me, I ask him a question. Do you really believe that South Africa will be free one day? This is 1982.
Mm.
He says, John, South Africa will be free, and we will govern.
Mm.
By the way, if you're detained, they're going to ask you about us. Why would you deny you met us? That's what I would do normally.
Mm-hmm.
Because we exist. Anyway, you're doing a disservice to our existence and the continuation of the struggle.
Mm.
Two, if they ask you what we talked about, tell them. What's your problem? We're talking about family. We're talking about this. We're not telling you the operations. Mm-hmm. We're not in the operators. We're not in the MK.
Mm.
We miss home, we miss pap and this, we miss so-and-so. We ask you, is so-and-so still alive? Mm. No, he passed away. What happened to so-and-so? That was the conversation generally of missing home and what's going on with my life with theaters. Says, we cannot tell you where the MK operations are going to be because we also don't know.
But when we're looking, John, at your work, because your work seems to straddle the, if you like, the pre 1994 era and the post 1994 era, how has the role of your role as an artist changed? Would you say it has changed, or is it stayed the same in that period in terms of the kinds of stories that you are wanting to tell?
There has not really changed. There was a big question in 1994: what's going to happen to protest theatre?
Mm-hmm.
It's dead. Now we're going to do what? We don't know. Because there was the removal, so in inverted commas, of the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Our work targeted the establishment, its roles, its culture, its everything. So now in 1994, South Africa has a new problem. And that problem is us, that we are part of the problem and also part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So we should focus mostly on dealing with the solution, on promoting the new democracy, which is a new word that I never heard of before during the struggle.
Mm.
All I heard was liberation, struggle, our country, our land. It was out of that negotiations that came out a new word that needed to be explained, democracy. And then we had to now work out what is this democracy is. And some of my plays, like Nothing But the Truth, was exactly when the TRC was examining what is this democracy? What is this truth and reconciliation? Who's asking to be forgiven? Why do I organize the truth and reconciliation and invite the people who hurt me so much to come and ask for my forgiveness? It was not their own initiative to try and create a peaceful coexistence within the people that were at war with each other. We run all this reconciliation thing, this creating a rainbow nation, this talk about non-racialism. It's our program. It's not the program of the people who were hell-bent on segregation and apartheid. So my work begins to examine that. My next play, which was, of course, missing, it was that exiles coming back at home, because it has been this of, I want to go home. When we get home, especially those who married the natives of the countries where they were housed and hosted. Like if you're in England, you married an English woman. If you're in America, you marry an American person. If you're in Europe, you marry a French woman, a white thing. So the coming home and being confronted by the attitudes, even within the black family, the comment that, while they welcome me as a brother, and I say, this is my wife. All right. Yeah. Because my wife is white, and my daughter, who is colored, who's always been in Africa. I'm an African, looking, of course, at National Geographic and the CNN and the British, seeing Africa. And now she arrives in New Brighton. This is where I am.
Mm.
This is where I was born. I'm trying to say this is the streets, and they keep saying, because we're driving from the airport through White Port Elizabeth, lush and streets, we go to the dusty roads right into New Brighton, right to Zwide, next to the Den Kirk Stadium. So they're saying this is 2003. Where the hell is this freedom, this democracy you've been talking about? My daughter is confronted with the fact that she's seen as colored. And of course, the fact that the character that I play was part of the leadership abroad. So he expected to be part of not only the negotiations, but also government, but was never called. I remember one day I asked Thabo Mbeki, during the negotiations, was there someone out there you missed who thinks he should have been in the negotiations? He should be in the cabinet. Mm-hmm. He should be. And he said, we're humans, John. There are people we didn't. There are people who didn't want to come home at all. Some people like Arthur Maimane went to one look and moved out. Joe Mhodes took one look and moved out. And there's many, many others took one look and said, well, I am that country that I come from. Mm. Right. So now with Kunene and the King, is again, I'm examining this kind of neoliberalism. So now in my play, I'm present, Kunene and the King. I'm here. Mm-hmm. Now, I always take something in, digest it, live with it, and suddenly later it comes as an art form. Mm-hmm. I don't write from the letterheads, from the headlines of newspapers. Mm-hmm. So I'm catching up, I'm coming. So where I am now, I'm in 2023 with Kunene and the King, where a white liberal, very liberal, never voted for Nationalist Party, but never voted at all. Never did anything to black people, but did not even want to see it. Now he's an actor, he's going to play King Lear, and he wants, he's sick, he's dying of cancer. So he needs someone to look after him. Mm-hmm. So he calls the nursing agency, because he's got money, he doesn't want to go to a hospice. So the nursing agency says, we're going to send Sister Kun to look after you. So I knock on the door, he missed it. It's Sister Kunene, not Sister Kun. I'm black, and the first thing he sees me calls the police. There's a black man in my flat, my house. There's a black man's going to rob me. So I'm trying to say the language we use, our attitudes are embedded within us. We need a re-education of self in order to fully accept non-racialism. Mm. It's not something that's going to happen by osmosis. Mm. There's too much in each of us of the past. Mm. And that past must come to a point where we honestly confess on the table and say, teach me, I will teach you. Mm.
And the just to go back to the truth, the whole question of reconciliation and forgiveness, how far do you think as a country we've made progress? Do you think
put a large band-aid around the wound. Mm. The problem with the band-aid, it has to be removed sometimes. Mm. And when you remove it, the scabs of the wound are still there, urching. And once a time, the one, as you scratch, there's a little bit of bleeding. Mm. It's still there because it was not a national project by all the people. Mm. There were people who totally did not buy into into reconciliation. In Kunene and the King, I say to the white character, I don't think you even went to the Truth and Reconciliation. He says, why would I go there? Hmm. There was nothing to be forgiven for. I didn't harm any of you black people. I didn't go there. There was nothing to be forgiven for. You see, so there is still simmering below. We could have all the rugby in the sport. We could have the progress, but it's all measured. It's all measured. Even by media, it's measured on how far we've moved into creating this non-racial society. Mm-hmm. When you become the chief editor of the Sunday Times, there are articles written. Suddenly, your credentials are investigated. Mm. Your degrees are investigated. But it was Mr. Sutherland who was chief editor. Life is normal. Mm. When a black businessman suddenly makes money and invests on the stock exchange, we've got to find out if there were any other tenders that led him to making so much money. There are people who were, who made it their own duty, and most of them are white, to discredit black excellence, black achievement, and black leadership. Now, I call black people who now join in that, in the, in that choir, that they are his master's voices. They are now black in boardrooms criticizing. It's not, you criticize people. For me, I don't understand that when you criticize the government, you should criticize the 400 people of that National Assembly. You should criticize in all the 9 provinces. They form government. They get salaries that are plus a million a year. All of them. And they are government. Why then, when there is a problem of a pothole and suddenly there's something called the ANC, suddenly there's something called the ruling party, what about the fact that we're government? It's our responsibility. We are discussing these things and the challenges of our economy, of the infrastructure, of housing, together as a government. So when we fail to deliver as we supposed, suddenly now it's a black failure. Now, when you get all the, look, I've worked in the Western Cape, in Swellendam now, they're burning the municipal offices. It's a Western Cape. The premier is white. Well, the city of Cape Town mess. So why is the ANC now responsible for the no service delivery in Khayelitsha? Why? Because the mindset is that we have to make the black government appear as not making it. Now, I have now, being black, become so eloquent in criticizing black leadership because it's comfortable in the boardroom. It's comfortable in the new society structures that I want to assimilate into. I can't talk about black excellence. So my work is about that. I'm sorry. My stories are those that one question me, why is this happening? Because I had an idea what South Africa would look like.
And what was the idea that you
had? I moved to Houghton and they move out. I don't care where they go. They can go to Swartkop. They can go to Soweto. I had that radical thing that we're all going to move in this way. It's 2023. Have you driven down Soweto? Have you driven into Freedom Park, Chris Hani, squatter camps? And you think, what have we done all this? Why was it impossible? I live in Johannesburg. I drive up the N1. M1 North. I turn Greyston left into Sandton. I turn right into Alex. Surely, my brother, surely by now, the richest metro in South Africa as a whole, I could venture to say somehow in the world, has not solved the living conditions of Alex. If I was mayor, I would stop any new development in Sandton with those glass buildings and say, let us rebuild Alex into a suburb with trees and houses and everything. It'll cost us so little in the Joburg budget. So I don't know. They bother me, those things. Gender-based violence. I can't sleep at night. I've got 3 daughters, 4 sons. I don't know that phone when it rings. What is it going to say? I've got grandchildren, 10. I've got sisters living in Port Elizabeth, living in Cape Town, living in Pretoria. I'm nervous the phone's going to ring that somebody has messed it up. Somebody's done this. And I was saying to somebody, is it enough to say we are men against gender-based violence, against femicide, against abuse of children and all? So what do we need to do actually? What happened to the street committee? What happened to those regional structures? When somebody reported that they broke into the door and they stole the radio or the TV, and the street committee brought it back in 2 hours. I don't know, it was rough justice. I'm not going to defend that. It was rough justice. And that justice was called kangaroo courts. You know, taking the law into your hands. But it had immediate effect in stopping crime within the black community.
One of the things that fascinate people is you started out on stage in the theater. And then later on, you were also in movies and that kind of thing. Which do you, would you say gives you more fulfillment? You've done Black Panther.
Yeah, I've done Black King.
And all the lights, Lion King.
Like Hollywood knows me now.
Yes.
It's funny, you know. I was talking to, when Denzel Washington came to South Africa. A couple of years ago, I invited him to come to the market and we had discussions. And he just asked, why did you not stay in Hollywood? Why did you go back? Morgan Freeman, I had a lunch with him. And he said, why are you not playing Nelson Mandela? You know, they don't understand why I came back to South Africa. And therefore my agent, which is the Miller Morris Agency, which is in New York and Hollywood, was also questioning, how do we serve you? You're so far away, so out of the way. I said, it only could happen after 94. After 94, then I began to open up and make myself available. Then I started doing movies. And these movies for me is solve the question of rent. Because then they give me the opportunity to do what I love best, the theater and writing. But if I do 7 plays of theater in a row, I'm still poor. If I do one movie, I'm comfortable for the next 3 years. You see? And then it happened for some strange reason. I don't understand. I think it was 5 years ago, I got a call from Hollywood. My agent says they're shooting Captain America. You know, those are big series, man. Avengers. They want to introduce the character of the Black Panther, which will be another hero from a continent called, from a country called Wakanda. It's part of the it's a comic book that they know. It's been there all the time. You remember those comic book Phantom Men?
Yes.
And then that was, there's one, the Black Panther's been there. I think it started in 1969. So they decided that they're going to do this. They want you to play King T'Chaka. Your son is going to become the Black Panther. So when your son takes your ring, becomes the Black Panther, that now Chadwick, then we will be able to launch the Black Panther series. Out of the blue. So I go to Hollywood. We open in a massive studios. And I walk in. Everybody stops. Marvel comes down to introduce me. Everybody there, I studied you. I saw you at Yale University. When I was a student, I saw you there. I saw you there. I saw you there. When I was there, and I thought, these people have always known who I am. But suddenly, I don't know. Luck or the ancestors just said, shine a light on him. It's his turn now. Now I have a string of offers.
Now, the other thing that I was wanting to, you know, to ask you, you're turning 80, but you're a sprightly 80. you're not like looking anything like, you know.
I got good genes, Mike.
Yes. I mean, someone might say, you, at your age, you've done everything that you would have liked to do. Now, are there other frontiers that you would like to explore?
It's okay to be like a front runner. It's okay to be a person who makes things possible, who opens doors for the other generation coming. But you need also to prepare that generation for the things they don't know that come with fame. You need also to prepare that generation how that maintenance of financials when you are an artist and you know nothing about finances. Also, we need to get to a point where arts play a critical role in nation building, in reconciliation, in social justice, you know, that we see artists respected and recommended. When Biden is running for presidency, he has to state clearly what is his policy towards the arts. Then he will get the actors, and because actors will a huge influence in the on the voter population. When you in England, you have to not just I'm a minister of the arts and blah 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 and heritage. You got to address the arts community and say, as a president, as a party, if we win, this is what we will do. Now, when you if I could get my government to that point, that recognizes the importance and the input of the arts into creating a normal society, into creating a creative society, into integrating the arts in the educational curriculum so that the children know that if you are an artist, you're not just lazy because you don't want to get a job. You don't know how many parents come to me to talk their kids out of wanting to be an artist. I said, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that?
Isn't that what your old man tried to do?
Of course he did. But I'm talking, that was in the 60s, so he had no idea.
Yes.
Right. Mm. But now, also I'm very proud by the fact that I bumped into somebody who said, you came to speak at my school. I'm now the commission chief editor of a big a company within the creative industry. I'm working for DSTV, I'm working for SABC. I said there, my parents understood that there is a future in what I want to do because I kept saying, look at John Gunn, look at John Gunn. So that makes me proud in that way. But I still believe that we have not given the arts culture a dignified space within just the structure of government and its structure of the society as a whole. We have not fully recognized the importance of arts in the education of a child and of a society. And I can say that these past 5 years, I have seen a lot of improvement. I mean, the latter years of the Department of Sports, Arts and Culture, there's been a great movement of trying to move into this constituency and understand the needs. And we, said one time that even the president must at some stage when he delivers the son make reference to the arts and culture. And that would help to get the people's mind into thinking it is a viable choice as a profession. Because it does two things, it entertains and it educates.
But where do you see yourself in all of that?
As a storyteller, I'd love to sit down with 1,000 kids and tell them about the once upon a time there was a monster called apartheid when they have no idea of what I'm talking about. No idea. I'd love one day just to speak to movement of artists to use the art as it speaks directly to the population about certain things that are critical in our society to build a good, stable society, an economy that gives people the dignity of a job, the dignity of a place called a house. I'm not talking four blocks making an RDP house. When I can drive to work and drive through suburbs. Right. So my stories will continue at 80 because now I have the privilege of saying what I like and not apologize and don't care the hell how it affects me.
and you'd be on stage, you'd still be writing, in other words.
Writing will continue. Directing is getting much stronger. Movies are wonderful. I've just did a movie in England called The Tichborne Claimant, and we needed a judge at the Old Bailey. And the actor coming, Sir John Gielgud, he was 94. He came on set and we set him down. And there he delivered the summation of a long, one of the longest running cases in England about suing the state or suing the I call it His Majesty's Royal, whatever. But he was 94. So it gives me this kind of hope that maybe my last performance would be at 95, where I just sit down on a chair and start the play. And then they wheel me off and then come in later and finish the play, which I had written and directed, and be paid more than them put together. No, I have
so
no...
You're not intending to stop
I don't know
sit
because
under a tree and...
No, it was not like that for me. I had the purpose of becoming an artist. I had a target. I had a commitment. I had a journey I wanted. And I don't see the end of it yet. I still feel there's so much still to be done.
And how do you relax, just lastly?
Family.
Because you seem to be fit. Do you exercise? Do you run?
No. I walk. I do a lot of walking around the house and around there and around my neighborhood. My son is trying to make me jog. And I've been asking him to explain.
This is Atandwa?
No. Matandwa is in New York, but he's back here for me now. No, Mazwana and this and all the others. I've got four sons. Now, he would say to me, let's jog. I said, no, make me understand. We're going to run from here to 5 kilometers, ne? And then make a U-turn somewhere and end up here. I'm here already. I can't see the point of us going 5 kilometers that way. The purpose of that whole thing is to be back where I'm standing. I'm in Diego. I'm here already.
So it's lifestyle.
It's my diet. It's the food I eat. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do, and I don't do nothing that I know that my body is my instrument. My body is, my voice is the only equipment I have. My health is a guarantee to a job. My morals and discipline and decency are why I'm attractive to great roles and great producers. I don't carry baggage that he could have, should have, not have. I have looked after the brand John Carney with jealousy. If you say to me, can you be join us? I says, I look at it, how it's going to impact on who I am. I've turned down more movies than I've done. Because I will not do something that is a disservice to humanity. And until all people on the face of the earth, and not one of them is in prison as we speak because of what they believe in, because an ideology that they hold that could be different from those that are in power. As long as that is happening, I have a job to do. As long as there's a child who cannot go to school, who is abused, I have a job to do. As long as there's a woman who is abused and cannot get out of a very violent and mean society, as long as there's a man who is being ostracized by society because of sexual preference, I have a job to do. You see, I'm loading myself, and my mom would say, you're not Jesus. Some of the things you must just walk past. I said, I can't. My problem is I see. That's my problem. I see and I feel. And I bothers me to see an old woman with 16 bags, plastic bags, carrying food, and she's in her 70s. She had children. She made dreams of children come true. It's not black decks, you fools. It is decency. It is being human. It is African to look after parents and grandparents. It is African. It's not black text. It's African. And you young boys pay lobola. It's an investment into your future and the future of my daughter. Because I don't want that, but I'm going to give it back to you anyway. But don't tell me that it's an archaic custom. And when other countries and other nations are sticking into their culture, some of those cultures are centuries old, but every year they celebrate those cultures. I can talk about everything, except I must not talk about Sharpeville. I must not talk about the youth uprising. I must not talk about apartheid. We've moved on. How does my son know how we got here? How does my son not value this democracy and understand that it cost? There's a price to it, and that price is lives. So we will constantly refer to that past. And it is a critical component in the present to decide our future.
John, thank you very much.